The date is November 16th, 1990, and we're watching Home Alone. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Merry Christmas!
Oh, and happy holidays once again. Happy last night of Hanukkah, and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Marv to my Harry.
I'm Colin Stewart.
And, well, another Christmas movie needs another Christmas guest. So we've brought in our friend Joel Sims. Joel, welcome.
Hello. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So Home Alone, we were talking a little bit before we started here, and you said that you forgot how much you loved this movie. What is it about Home Alone?
I think that the big thing for me with Home Alone is that when I was a kid watching this movie, I was like, I'm the youngest in my family.
Okay.
So it's not a huge family, like a McAllister kind of family, but it's one of those movies that just really appeals to like the kid inside of you, you know? It's just the idea of this kid who's home alone, doing whatever he wants, just like that freedom that he has.
Yeah.
Everything, and... you know, he's just running around making big hot chocolate and marshmallows everywhere and dancing around and watching raunchy movies. Like, you're like, when you're a kid, you see that and you're like, yeah, well, and that's what it is.
And being the youngest in your family, you probably really identified with the fact that Kevin is the youngest in his family.
Oh, yeah. And I also kind of looked like him when I was younger.
Okay.
Which really, I was like, yeah, I get it.
So now we have been asking of all our guests that have been joining us for these Christmas movies, and what is your usual go-to Christmas movie?
Ooh, I haven't thought about that in a little bit. Oh, it's going to be Rudolph.
Rudolph?
Rudolph. It's a family tradition. Every year we watch the Rudolph. Like the
old stop motion.
Yeah.
The terrifying.
Yukon Cornelius. Yeah. An all-time classic.
See, and I always forget whether it's that one or Santa Claus is Coming to Town, which is the same old-school stop-motion animation. Which one has the elf that wants to be the dentist? That's Rudolph, right?
Oh, that is Rudolph, and okay. That's Hermie the Elf.
Hermie the Elf.
Who right. I also identified with a lot, because I was young and really short and had, like, really blonde hair and also wanted to be a dentist. So for from grade 5 until grade 8, people called me Hermie the Elf a lot.
Outstanding.
So every time I hear that word, there's a pang of dislikes. Brings me right back to that getting made fun of in grade 5.
That PTSD flashback moment.
That's the horror moment. You know? How veterans walked out of Saving Private Ryan, I walk out of Rudolph every time Herbie comes on screen.
So this week, we're looking back at November 1990, when the movies in theaters were Jacob's Ladder, Child's Play 2, Rocky 5, The Rescuers Down Under, a lot of sequels again, and of course, our movie for today, Home Alone, which earned $476.7 million on a $15 million budget.
Home Alone also recently celebrated its 30th anniversary, and so if you haven't watched it by now, I mean, I have no words for you. Home Alone is my favorite Christmas movie by far, so if you haven't watched it, then as far as I'm concerned, you don't really deserve to listen to this podcast, but I still want you to listen to it, so you should press pause, go watch it, and just have a blast. Pretend that I'm watching it with you in spirit, and then come back and listen to this podcast.
There you go.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, well, again, I've found multiples, but I just couldn't choose between the four that I found. So the first, straight into the point, holy cow. That's the whole tagline.
Just the two words.
Just the two words with an exclamation point. Or we have a family comedy without the family. That one's pretty good. Or this non-family comedy is a real scream.
That one makes it sound like a horror movie a little
bit. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
That has a really ominous undertone to
but
it.
But then when you watch it and you realize just how much Kevin screams, it's constant.
Everybody.
Now
everybody.
It makes sense. Yeah. And finally, probably the most comprehensive tagline, when Kevin's family left for vacation, they forgot one minor detail. Kevin. But don't worry, he cooks, he cleans, he kicks some butt.
I thought it was just going to end at Kevin, and they were like, no.
Nope.
We need a little extra spice in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and we've got a colon in there after detail. We've got an ellipses after don't worry. That last one is quite thorough, but to fill in the blanks of what's missing, we'll go to Cullen for a 60-second synopsis.
All right. So for my probably 500th viewing of Home Alone, here we go. Kevin McAllister hates his family, and the feeling is mutual. Kevin's family hates him so much that they accidentally, in quotation marks, leave him behind while they fly off on a trip to Paris. Now left home alone, Kevin finds himself engaged in a battle to defend his home from a pair of local thieves, while his negligent mother finally realizes the error of her ways and struggles to make her way back home to her son. That's my 60-second synopsis.
Right on. Okay, Home Alone, directed by Chris Columbus, who must love working with kids, because his directing credits include Home Alone 2 and the first couple Harry Potter movies, Mrs. Doubtfire, the first Percy Jackson, Adventures in Babysitting, plus non-kid movies like Pixels and the very hated screen adaptation of the musical Rent. That is terrible.
In keeping with Christmas movies, I decided to watch Jingle All the Way today.
Okay.
And it also happened that Chris Columbus is a producer on that movie.
Oh.
So maybe, I don't know if he just loves Christmas, but there we go.
So it's produced by Tarkin Gotch.
Gesundheit.
Who is more known as a music supervisor, but is making his producing debut here. Future producer credits are Dutch, Curly Sue, which are both John Hughes movies, and Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is starring David Hasselhoff as Nick Fury.
They're all so similar.
Right?
You know, they just go hand in hand.
It's also produced by Mark Levinson, who has 15 producer credits, some of which are Mystic Pizza, Ruskies, Teen Wolf, and also produced by Scott Rosenfeld, who has 56 producing credits, also Mystic Pizza and Teen Wolf, plus Smoke Signals and Lenny the Wonder Dog, whatever the fuck that is. And, of course... It is written by the incomparable John Hughes, who we talked about in glowing terms in our Planes, Trains, and Automobiles episode. The writer behind such classics like The Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Uncle Buck, The Great Outdoors, Curly Sue, Dutch, Beethoven, Flubber, and the Vacation movies. And so we open the movie with some very Harry Potter sounding music, which I suppose makes sense considering the director and the fact that the legendary John Williams is the composer for both. But did anybody notice that at the beginning, there's that very eerie, spooky sounding music? And it's just, it's almost like he ripped it off when he did the Harry Potter music.
A little bit. I think that spooky music is the reason they wrote the spooky sounding tagline earlier. And then they scrapped that one. I think they kind of went hand in hand. I didn't know it was John Williams who composed for this movie. I was doing looking up the credits of the film, and I learned that. I was like, his score was nominated for an Academy Award.
Which one of his scores wasn't?
Exactly. They just saw the name John Williams and they just, it's like Meryl Streep, you know, you just toss him a nomination, fill the roster a little bit.
I never thought about the comparison to Harry Potter, but now that you mention it, it does sound very similar.
Yeah.
It would have been interesting if he had gone a different route and done a more Star Wars type.
So we are taken in the front entrance of the McAllister home, where there is a flurry of activity, kids running around, up and down the stairs, sword fighting in the stairs, and in the middle of all this activity, we see a uniformed police officer trying to get people's attention as they rush by. This is Harry, played by Joe Pesci, who reprises his role in Home Alone 2. He's in Raging Bull, My Cousin Vinny, Goodfellas, JFK, Lethal Weapon 2, 3, and 4, The Irishman, and he appeared in a couple of Michael Jackson videos. In his attempts to get an adult to talk to, he manages to stop a couple of kids out of the large menagerie. One tells him that, yes, their parents are here, but they aren't the homeowners. The other says their parents are in France. All sorts of chaos. I've never understood the full family dynamic here, so maybe Colin as like a 50-time watcher.
I was actually wondering about that. More in the context of like how they end up leaving Kevin behind, just because it's like why are the like Peter and Mary responsible for the entire family? Like, I don't know about your guys' family, but you know, every set of parents looks after their own kids, kind of thing. It's like,
mm-hmm.
did you say Mary as the mom? Because I have in my notes Kate McAllister.
Is it Kate?
I mean, either of us could be right in this situation, but yeah, that's what I have in my notes. So I'll be referring to her.
It is Kate. It is Kate McAllister.
Okay.
The IMDb confirms.
But yeah, so like how many actual McAllister kids are there? Like actual siblings of Kevin? There's four.
Two.
Two?
I thought there was only two. I thought there's Buzz.
There's Buzz.
And then the sister.
Yeah, well, I thought it was two sisters, and aren't they like twin sisters? Too many kids running around. But yeah, I didn't catch how many actual kids there are. But then it's like, I don't actually know.
Fuller is definitely not one of Kevin's. He's like a cousin, right?
Even though, ironically, he is actually the brother.
Yeah, Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah. We cut to an upstairs bedroom where mom, Kate McAllister, is on a phone. And this is Catherine O'Hara, who is from SCTV and a movie called After Hours with John Hurd. She was in Dick Tracy, which I didn't know. Wyatt Earp, Beetlejuice, and a bunch of those Spinal Tap movie guys. She's in like Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind. Kate McAllister could have been played by Kirstie Alley, but she is being bothered.
That fits.
90s Kirstie Alley, absolutely, but she was too busy doing Look Who's Talking. But she is being bothered by her youngest son Kevin, and Kevin of course is Macaulay Culkin, who was definitely huge in the 90s with movies like Uncle Buck, My Girl, The Good Son, Home Alone 2, Pagemaster, Richie Rich, and a few Michael Jackson videos as well. He was also in a Christmas special playing a record executive to Mrs. Murtaugh, Darlene Love, All Alone for Christmas. And then he sort of faded off and tried to make a comeback with Party Monster. But he's never really been more than that kid from Home Alone. Kind of like Haley Joel Osment is always that kid from The Sixth Sense.
He never moved on. It's like just like Haley Joel Osment never outgrew his baby face. Macaulay Culkin never really outgrew the Home Alone legacy. Like every time anybody looks at him, they're like, that's not Macaulay Culkin. That's Kevin McAllister right there.
What's funny is he actually reprises the role of Kevin McAllister in like a short film called Drivers, like spelled D-R-Y-V-R-S, which is basically Kevin McAllister is working for a rideshare company like Uber or Lyft, and this one's called Drivers, and he's like suffering from major PTSD because of like these events of his childhood of being left alone. I'll post this on our social media because it's like a 5-minute video, but it is so funny because of like his abandonment issues and the fact that he's fought off these criminals twice. It's a funny little show.
I remember seeing him a couple of years ago, or maybe it was a couple of years ago. He did a commercial for like the Google Home.
Kevin is complaining that Uncle Frank won't let him watch a certain movie, and he's also upset by the sleeping arrangements with all these extra people in the house because he has to share a bed with his bedwetting cousin Fuller, which is such a great name for this kid that is always drinking and guilty of wetting the bed, this kid named Fuller.
I'm a big fan of all the names here, like Buzz. I love that like 90s, 80s movies trope of like, you want the kid to be the asshole? His name is Buzz, Biff, or Spike. Take your pick.
Yeah.
It's like a spotlight on them that's like, this guy sucks.
And it might not even be a nickname. It might be his actual, on his birth certificate, God-given name. You know?
McAllister, Buzz.
Is Buzz short for something like Dick or Bill or... I'm trying to think. The only real life Buzz I can think of is Buzz Aldrin, but I don't know.
Yeah,
I think that's a nickname. Yeah,
I don't think Buzz Aldrin is, but maybe it is. Maybe that's an old school thing. But also in the bedroom is Dad Peter McAllister, who we joked about in Lethal Weapon could be the heroin dealer from Lethal Weapon. He's complaining about not having an electrical adapter for his razor for France, which mom suggests he could grow a goatee. So Dad is played by John Hurd, who has 179 credits. He was in Home Alone 2, White Chicks, Beaches, Awakenings, Sharknado. I remember him best from Big, though. Fed up with Kevin being all up in her shit, mom sends Kevin to go pack. And an awful lot to ask of an 8-year-old the night before you're supposed to leave on an international trip. Because Kevin doesn't know how to pack a suitcase. And as his family points out, he's completely useless, you know, because he's 8.
Yeah.
So
you're 8 years old, you're not paying your own taxes yet. What are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, like
get to the working line,
start,
you know?
Start
providing for your family. So come on, Kev.
So Kevin goes to his older brother Buzz for help, and Buzz, like Joel mentioned, is a dick and won't let him sleep in his room, even if you were growing on my ass, he says. But their conversation Their conversation is interrupted by the sound of a metal garbage can scraping outside, and they watch the creepy neighbor from next door, Marley, who is played by Robert Blossom, who has 59 credits all the way back to 1959. He was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Doc Hollywood, The Quick and the Dead, Escape from Alcatraz. In that movie, he cuts off his fingers. So Marley has his hand all wrapped up in a bandage. And something that I actually read is that there is like a metaphor happening with Marley if you watch him closely throughout the movie, because he starts off the movie with this big bandage around his hand as he's dragging out his garbage can. And then when we see him a bit later, he's only got like a piece of gauze on his hand. And then when we see him in the church, he's only got band-aids on his hand. And then when we see him at the end hugging his granddaughter, his wounds are healed. So they say that there's like this metaphor going through the movie of like time heals all wounds, and that they actually put like a physical example of that on the character whose emotional life is healing. And I thought, wow.
I like that.
Holy shit. There were actually a couple other things that I read that were pointed out that I had never noticed. Kevin in the beginning is often filmed from a higher up angle so that he looks smaller and meeker. And then as the movie goes on, he's filmed more from below so that he looks taller and like just more...
A little more imposing.
Yeah, and the one other fun fact that I read about this is if you look around, there's red or green in every scene, because they wanted to make sure that subconsciously you always knew that it was Christmas in this movie. There's always something red or green. It's, you know, the wallpaper or the couches or Kevin's red sweater. There's always something red or green in there because they always wanted to make sure that those colors were in the movie, which I found fascinating. But Buzz tells Kevin the story of Old Man Marley, back to Old Man Marley here, being the shovel slayer and using the salt in his garbage can to turn the bodies of his deceased into mummies. Downstairs, we get the pizza guy from Little Nero's Pizza, and he shows up with $122.50 worth of pizza and knocking over the McAllister's bronze jockey statue in the process. I love the running joke of the statue getting knocked over. It happens four times in the movie, twice from this guy, once from the cop, and once from the airport shuttle vans. I just love the running joke of the bronze jockey. So the pizza guy is led into the house by the cop, Harry, who is still standing in the entranceway trying to find an adult. Uncle Frank, who we saw as the sexual predator executive in Secret of My Success. And actually, Uncle Frank, the part was written for Kelsey Grammer. And I also read that there was a rumored original draft where Uncle Frank is actually the real bad guy of this movie. He's like a kingpin, and the wet bandits work for him.
Interesting.
I wonder how they would have found a way to make that work in a way that was like, yeah, this is for kids, by the way.
Yeah.
You're like, you know, yeah, there's a big mob ring where they're trying to, you know, destroy their family from the inside, but it's for kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, like, the later, like, the non-Macaulay Culkin Home Alone movies, which no one should ever watch, but I at least have, I at least watch the trailers.
Yeah.
They're all, like, they're all way more sophisticated. They're like the Fast and the Furious. You know the part of Fast and the Furious where The Rock comes in and the whole team becomes spies? Like,
yeah.
The later Home Alones, the kid is taking on, like, international bank robbers.
Oh, it's like Spy Kids. Home Alone : Spy Kids.
There you go.
Like a crossover, Antonio Banderas shows up.
I just like thinking it would be a Home Alone, like, Tokyo Drift kind of deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean... The one I watched, because the later ones, they have to also account for now there's cell phones.
Yeah.
The kid is, like, way more technological. Like, they're using computers and stuff to mess with them. And
Laser fields and, like, high-tech security systems. So Uncle Frank relieves the pizza guy of his arm load, but passes the buck for the payment to Peter. Oh, I don't live here. You know, my brother will pay. So now two people are waiting in the entrance, but finally Mom comes by to pay the pizza guy, and Harry has finally found a homeowner. So he informs her that he's checking on people's vacation plans and their security. He finds out they're all headed to France in the morning, and on the way to the kitchen for some pizza, Kevin gets a glimpse of the cop, especially his gold tooth, which we get the little ding and sparkle.
Classic.
By the time Kevin arrives in the kitchen, all the plain cheese pizza is already claimed. Oh no! And I should point out that I was watching everyone at the table, and absolutely no one in the kitchen is actually eating plain cheese pizza. So how an entire plain cheese pizza has gone missing when everyone else's pizza has at least olives on it, I don't understand. This sets Kevin over the edge. He's sick of this full house. He can't take it anymore. And a fracas breaks out around the table, and drinks are getting knocked over. And in the scuffle, they're soaking the passports and plane tickets, which Dad scrambles to clean up. And on this viewing, I noticed for the first time ever that one of the plane tickets with Kevin's name on it accidentally gets thrown out in this scene.
Yeah. Maybe they scoop it off, right?
I've never, ever noticed that detail. And I thought, wow, like that explains why when they get to the airport, they're not like, oh shit, I've got an extra ticket. It was a detail that I've never seen before and fully appreciated. It was amazing to me.
It's one of those things that, you know, the director was like, everybody is going to notice that immediately. It explains so much. Nobody's going to have any questions later on. Yeah. And 20 years later, for the first time ever.
Amazing. 30 years later. Oh my god.
Yeah. Oof.
I saw this in theaters. So everyone is furious at Kevin. Uncle Frank tells him he's a little jerk because he's ruined everything. And so to punish him, Mom makes him sleep in the attic. And luckily, he doesn't have to sleep with his bedwetting cousin anymore. As Mom is escorting him to the attic, he yells at her, wishing they would all disappear. Well, maybe you'll get your wish, she says. Although we know what's about to happen, Kevin never did have an opportunity to finish packing because of this. And we never actually see Kevin in his own bedroom. Have you ever thought of that? He sleeps in his parents' bed. We see him in Buzz's room. We see him in the attic. Yeah. We never actually see this kid that's home alone in his own room.
Yeah, that's true. I never thought of that.
He just treated it like an Airbnb. He was just sleeping wherever he wanted. He chose the bed that was the biggest.
Yeah. When he makes his wish, his mom tells him that he'd be pretty upset to wake up and find everybody gone. And before falling asleep, he once more wishes his family would disappear. And we get a little bit more of the Harry Potter sounding music, giving his wish a supernatural quality, like Tom Hanks' wish in Big. And the wind picks up outside, and it ends up blowing a tree down on the power lines, causing the power to go out. All the clocks are now dead. Next morning, everyone has slept in with no alarms to wake them. And Mom gets woken up by the sound of the airport shuttle drivers knocking on the door and picking up the bronze jockey statue. They've slept in, and it's pandemonium in the house. Everyone's scrambling to get out the door. They're loading their luggage into the vans, and a headcount has been skewed by the arrival of the neighbor kid asking the van drivers a bunch of questions and looking through the bags. This kid actually auditioned for Kevin McAllister, the kid that asks all the questions. And you can see such a similarity between this kid and like the character that Macaulay Culkin plays in Uncle Buck asking all the questions. Because, you know, he's asking about gas mileage and he's asking about just, you know, where are they going? And but he throws off the headcount, and the family divides up into two vans and heads to the airport just as the power gets restored. And Mom gets the rundown of the headcount, including, of course, a partridge in a pear tree, because we have to remind everyone that it's Christmas.
And yeah, they're really nailing it in.
Yeah, that's right. But those vans, well, they're Dodge Ram vans, and I think it's time to talk about Sponsorship Corner! So, this is a huge one this week. Buckle up. Here we go. Home Alone is brought to you by Dodge, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, Avis, and Budget Rent-A-Cars, Panasonic and Emerson Electronics, Woman's Day, Playboy and Mad Magazine, American Airlines, Micro Machines, the Chicago Bulls, Coho Hockey Equipment, Pepsi, and Coke. But Coke is only shown once during the fake party, and it's taped to one of the dummy's hands. But Pepsi is fucking everywhere. Ready Whip, Adidas, Nikon Cameras, Dawn Soap, Arm & Hammer Detergent, Junior Mints, Frito-Lay's Crunch Taters, Kraft Macaroni and Cheese and Marshmallows, Skittles Candy, Brand Checks, Wrap It Plastic Wrap, Band-Aid, Shower-to-Shower Powder, Brute Cologne, Vista Scuba Masks, Colgate Plus Toothbrush, Frident, Chiclets, and Freshen Up Gum, Tic Tacs, Ultra Pampers, Planters Peanuts, Metro Trains, Bell Pacific Telephones, Right Guard Deodorant, Five Alive and Tropicana Juices, Tide Laundry Detergent, and Wonder Bread. Plus the cartoon, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, in the 1981 book Nobody's Angel by Thomas McGuane, which scored a 3.8 out of 5 on Goodreads with 446 people rating. And actually, a funny fact about that book, John Hurd is reading it, and both he and the author, Thomas McGuane, were both married to Margot Kidder, Lois Lane from the Superman movies. So that might be why he was reading it as a little joke.
There you go.
Yeah. But this has been...
If I'm cutting you off, but I think it's really funny that they had a sponsorship from basically every brand that was popular at the time, like everything, including the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
With Jordan on them, you know?
Yeah, they
only got $50 million.
There were a few that I saw in the basement that I couldn't quite make out, so I didn't feel right mentioning them, because it was either Drano or Liquid Plumber, and there was something that looked like Pine Sol. So there were a couple more, but I didn't feel right including those when I couldn't quite tell myself what they are. But this has been a very big sponsorship corner.
Have you been keeping a tally of all the sponsorship corners, and like which one is the longest so far?
I feel like that one was. Demolition Man was a real stretch, but that was a big one. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was another big one as well. But I don't know. Maybe one of our listeners out there wants to make us a flowchart and let us know. So
maybe one day we'll have our own fan wiki.
That's right. Well, because we always also ask the question of how many times has Hostess or Wonder Bread been mentioned, you know, and so that's another one that would be interesting to see how many of our movies have had Wonder Bread or Hostess Twinkies in them. So we watch as the family sprints through the airport trying to make their flight. They had 45 minutes to make the flight, something you wouldn't be able to get away with these days. They get to the gate just in time and are told to take whatever seat is left. In what world would a plane say take whatever is left? Like, things have changed. Like, assigned seating, like, they want to know where everyone is. I've been on flights where they get mad when people try to switch seats. And how is it that the first class seats are still vacant? Like, if these people are last minute arrivals, the door to the gate is getting closed. Someone hasn't been like, well, I'll take those seats since they didn't show up.
Yeah. Or even just take the extra leg room. I like how they got the uncle on there up to the first class somehow. And he's just sitting there swilling all the free champagne.
Yeah.
Absolutely living it up.
Well, I'm trying to put the crystal in his wife's purse too. the crystal salt and pepper shakers.
Yeah.
I do appreciate, though, how realistic all the circumstances have been up to this point, though, to make it appear legitimately possible that they could have forgotten Kevin. The fact that they say there's single seats left, you know, take whatever's left, you know, the fact that his ticket was thrown out, which I'm still blown away by that shit. But, like, the fact that, you know, they're running through the airport and the head count with the neighbor kit, like, it actually seems like it's legitimately possible that they could have done this.
Yeah. It's a remarkably tight script. Like, I realized that when I was rewatching it again.
Yeah.
Just like, again, it's like you said, it's like everything is accounted for. Because obviously I'm sitting there trying to be all cynical and look for all the plot holes and be like, well, actually. But really, there's not a lot.
He closed the loopholes.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that the intense violence at the end should result in more broken bones or blood or death.
They would have been dead.
Yeah, the one thing that I had noticed was when they got in the van and like the electrical person specifically mentions like the phone line is cut, so that later on when they try to call him, like they can't get through.
And the fact that they've got enough people that they have to go in two vehicles, like it just they've locked it up tight.
I did think that like most parents, I mean, I get there in a rush and everything, but I kind of think, like I was saying before, like if it was your kids, there's different check-in points. Like when you get to the, you might still kind of do a double count, but still they're in a rush, so they got to get where they're going. But
yeah. Meanwhile, back at the McAllister home, Kevin has woken up and starts searching the house for people, but can't find anyone. He goes outside to check the cars and sees them there in the open garage. I don't understand why the garage is wide open, but so he sees that they couldn't have gone to the airport without him.
That comes later, like when Peter, he mentions that he left the garage open.
Yeah, on the plane.
He does, but I still don't understand why it was open in the first place. Who goes to bed without closing the garage? Unless the power failure made them pop open, but that seems like a bit of a...
It would be the other way around, you would think.
Right? So Kevin comes to the next logical conclusion. He made his family disappear, which is dramatically repeated. I made my family disappear before this little kid goes absolutely fucking berserk, being a kid, running around the house, doing everything a kid would do if he thought he was now family free, jumping on the bed, running around and screaming on a sugar high, using Buzz's BB gun to shoot toys, sledding down the stairs on his toboggan and out the front door, going through his older brother's secret trunk full of Playboys, which they actually taped the pages together so that because Chris Columbus didn't want Macaulay Culkin to be able to see nudity, so they taped the pages together. You know, and he finds firecrackers and stuff, picture of his Buzz's girlfriend, which I felt bad for the kid, but It turns out that this is actually the art director's son dressed as a girl. Yeah, because again, Chris Columbus thought it would be too cruel to use a real girl for the punchline of woof.
I was thinking the same thing as I watched it. I just heard that line and I was like, hey, yikes, like yeah, poor girl.
Yeah, that's a little boy in a dress.
That's a slam to the self-esteem there.
Yeah. And of course, he's eating ice cream for supper and watching an R-rated movie, Angels with Filthy Souls. And of course, all the time he's calling out to the people to come and stop him. I dare ya. I'm eating ice cream for dinner. Isn't anyone going to stop me?
That's another, like, kind of what you were talking about, Joel, at the beginning about the childlike nature of this movie that I really like is the fact that, like, Kevin legitimately thinks his family is just, they've just actually disappeared. Like,
yeah, he's naive enough to believe that.
Yeah, there's magic in the world, and he just somehow made them disappear. And I also like, too, with that, how he often looks to the camera. Like, he's not really breaking the fourth wall, but it kind of does break the fourth wall. And I remember that when I was a kid, I think that was one of the things I really liked about this movie was because it was kind of like he was talking to me. And it's like, as a kid, you're like, oh, like I'm just like him. I can be just like him and that kind of stuff.
You're sharing a secret. So on the plane, Mom has the sneaking suspicion that she's forgotten something. She can't put her finger on it. Dad thinks it's bound to be the garage getting left open. I still don't understand why the garage was open. That's when it hits her. Kevin! She forgot Kevin! Oh, what kind of a mother am I? And Uncle Frank says, if it makes you feel any better, I forgot my reading glasses, which it was a funny line from the character that I absolutely hate. We cut to a plumbing van where we see Harry again, but shocking twist, holy shit, he's not a cop! It's a shocking revelation, I'm sure, like, of Luke, I am your father proportions, if we hadn't seen this movie, like, dozens of times. Like, 100 times between the three of us, I'm sure. Harry is in the van with his burglary associate, Marv, who is played by Daniel Stern, who reprises the role in Home Alone 2. The old man in Christmas Story 2, we talked about. Rookie of the Year, Very Bad Thing. Wonder Years, where he was the narrator of voice of Kevin Arnold. He's City Slickers 1 and 2. And his City Slickers role, he actually reprises in an episode of Westworld at one point. They are discussing the surveillance of the neighborhood that Harry has done, which families are gone, and the automatic timers on the houses, which he sits there and he's like, okay, that house is going to turn on now. Okay, wait. Next one. Now. Like, why are these seconds apart? I could understand if it was like, okay, that timer is going to go off at 7, that one's going to go off at 7:30, but this is, it's like literally, okay, this one is turning on at 7, this one's turning at 7 and 8 seconds.
The neighbors are all just really tight. They're just really good friends. They all have it all linked up. They're trying to save power and reduce their, you know.
Yeah, synchronize your watches and make sure that we don't all turn on at the exact same time.
Yeah, heaven forbid.
Put it a dozen seconds,
15 seconds between the house.
We don't want it to look suspicious.
Right. So he also points out the fact that the McAllister home is the crown jewel of their heist plan, or more accurately, the silver tuna. They head to the basement door to break in, but Kevin has heard them, so he turns on the basement light, and this is enough to make them unconfident in Harry's intel and back off for tonight. Kevin, though, is understandably freaked out and hides under the bed. and then decides he's being ridiculous and goes outside yelling, "He's not afraid anymore! He's not afraid anymore!" until promptly getting scared back into the house when he comes face to face with the neighbor Marley, and we get some Kevin screaming, which is what he does a whole lot in this movie.
Sounds like we buckle up for more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Paris, the family has landed and is once again working on their cardio by running through another airport. They get to a bank of payphones and prove why Americans get a bad reputation in Europe by forcing people off their phones. Mom hands out her really massive day timer with phone numbers for every person they know back home. The plan is to call everyone they know and get someone to check in on Kevin. But Mom, meanwhile, calls the Chicago police to try to get them to do a drive-by. And one of the cops, played by Larry Hankin, who we've already seen in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as the cab driver Doobie, she's getting the runaround from the cops, who don't quite understand what is being asked of them. But eventually they agree to send a cop by to check on Kevin. But Kevin, who is still skittish because of his close encounter with Harry and Marv, is still hiding under the bed and refusing to go check the door. There's no one there. Tell her to count her kids again, which is a great line from the cop. And this is actually Chris Columbus's father-in-law playing the cop in this movie. And we once again see that the bronze jockey statue is knocked over. Well, now it's time for Kevin to start taking his newfound freedom seriously and man up. He starts with getting ready in front of a mirror and monologuing, freshly showered and deodorizing, slapping his cheeks with aftershave, and screaming. Then he decides to do some shopping for a new toothbrush. There is actually a scene in the beginning where you see one of his brothers slip a toothbrush into his pocket. The theory is that, like, his brother packed Kevin's toothbrush instead, which is why Kevin has no toothbrush in this scene.
Okay. That makes more sense. I was curious, yeah. Like, that's the one thing he goes to the store for.
Yeah. Either that or because his mom didn't fucking pack for him and she relied on an 8-year-old to do it himself.
She really has a pick yourself up by your bootstraps mentality when it comes to this infant child.
Yeah, my son is 8. I know firsthand what a current 8-year-old looks like. So, He decides he has no money, so he decides to rob Buzz for cash. And as he's climbing the shelves, they fall down. I've always just loved just how the shelves collapse and he just falls. Like, I don't know why this stunt is just one of the funniest to me. But I also find it funny that Macaulay Culkin's stunt double is a really short 30-year-old man.
Really?
Yeah.
I was curious. I was really curious about that.
Yeah, it's not a dummy. It is an actual person. But yeah, he's just really short. We also do see here that Buzz's pet tarantula escapes.
I kind of thought it was weird how he ends up underneath all this stuff when it clearly looks like he would have fallen on top of it. And if he had fallen underneath, like, those boards are really, really sharp. Like, if you took one of those to the head, I feel like it's game over.
Yeah. The end.
Are you saying the movie that has people getting slammed in the face by full paint cans doesn't take, like, the body's mortality rate exceptionally seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, good point. Good point. I'll give you that.
So at the store, he's asking the clerk if the toothbrush he's picked out is approved by the American Dental Association. And while she's trying to get the answer to his question, creepy Marley walks in with his bloody hand to buy some Band-Aids. Kevin starts backing away from fear and forgets that he's holding a toothbrush and becomes an accidental shoplifter chased by a cop. But the intense stock boy goes after him and then sees a cop across the street and yells, "Hey, shoplifter!" Like, it's just so intense. And so,
anything for the job.
Yeah, that's right. The toothbrush. Oh no.
My favorite part of that scene is that when he's in the shop and the lady, like, calls for him, he's like, it's like he's Batman coming into action. He just, the way it's shot, he just, like, turns and he looks like Captain America or a superhero or something that, like, runs after him. And then that cop, like, what was that cop doing that he could just,
he was like writing a ticket, I thought.
He run after this kid.
Goes after the shoplifter anyway.
He was laying his life on the line for that toothbrush that cost $1.25.
That's right. Instead of, like, the $65 ticket he was probably given, you know, he's going to chase after a minor that he can't charge anyway. But he chases him across the park, but eventually loses him. But now, poor Kevin, he's become a thief, and he's lost in his thoughts and walking home dejectedly down the sidewalk. But in the neighborhood, Harry and Marv have been robbing a house, and from an answering machine message, they hear Peter McAllister talking about being in Paris. Marv has plugged the drains in the sink and turned on the taps because he has the idea for a calling card so they can be called the Wet Bandits. And they get in their van, and Marv is proud of his flooding idea, but Harry is furious and arguing with him as he starts driving away from the house. They're too distracted, and they don't see Kevin, who is also distracted, and come dangerously close to running him over, which is a very hilarious moment, and I found out they filmed this backwards. They made Macaulay Culkin walk backwards and put the van in reverse so that there was actually no danger of accidentally running him over.
That's interesting, because every time I watch that scene, something looks weird about it.
Yeah.
There's something weird about how the van stops and like he starts screaming that I've always noticed, but now that you mention that, it makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like the tongue getting stuck to the pole in A Christmas Story. Like, this is one of those things where I would have never thought of doing this. I would have been like, okay, someone be there ready to catch him. Which actually, when he's jumping on the bed in that opening scene, they actually have crew members hiding behind the bed out of shot, just in case Macaulay Culkin fell off the bed. They're there to catch him.
I like the idea of the risk of jumping on the bed being compared. I'll be like, we can just put him in front of the car and just not. Just give him like 3 inches between like his screaming and his face becoming part of the grill.
Yeah. So Kevin recognizes Harry because of his gold tooth, but he doesn't hide his surprise very well, making Harry suspicious, so they start tailing slowly behind Kevin to see which house he goes into. He starts picking up his pace, and then he realizes he's being followed, eventually breaking into a run, and he loses them around a corner for long enough to manage to hide in a nativity diorama in front of the church, which is very clever for an 8-year-old, but I'm wondering where this blanket and shepherd's cane came from, because nothing else in this nativity seems to be real fabric or movable parts.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Yeah, you don't just keep a cane and blanket on you at all times, yeah, just in case.
I think even in the manger, like the baby Jesus has like plastic blankets molded into. Yeah. Like, where did this blanket come from? But hey, good for him. He managed to do it. He just, you know, they might have wanted to throw a little bit more tapestries in that scene so that it seemed a little bit more realistic, but whatever.
maybe you should just send Chris Columbus an email on that one, Sean.
Yeah,
we could use the note.
Yeah. Dear Chris Columbus, I think you should go back and special edition.
No, for next time, pal.
Yeah, yeah, hey.
Yeah, listen here, buddy.
So, with a small inkling that Harry is a shady guy, that night Kevin sets up an elaborate fake party at his house. All the lights on, music blaring, Michael Jordan cut out on a toy train, a mannequin on a record player, and he's dancing with ropes attached to other mannequins to get them to move too. And, again, incredible ingenuity for an 8-year-old. And how he managed to set it up. And, I mean, I must say that this kid is really good at cleaning up after himself.
Yeah, like, honestly.
Yeah.
No wonder his mom thought he could pack his own suitcase. If he can set up this, I don't even know if I could tie my shoes properly when I was 8, let alone like make a whole mannequin display that looks realistic and moves.
Yeah. And like the whole scene where he's eating ice cream, they actually pan through the kitchen first where there's stuff dripping off the counters. Like the you expect that this house is going to be an absolute disaster, but somehow he cleans up after himself. So like the next morning, he's cleaned up all this party stuff before he went to bed, I guess. Like, I wish my kids were that good at chores.
He takes a lot of pride in his work.
Yeah,
he's the man of the house now. He's
exactly.
I mean, it also makes sense why he didn't get along with his family so much, because I mean, if he's that clean and kind of imaginative and that kind of thing, it makes sense why he was a little bit upset at all the chaos.
Well, I think that's the reason, sorry, we didn't see his room, is because it looks like a hospital room with how just scarily clean it is. Yeah. Like, it's just bleached white walls and, like, cream sheets. Yeah.
He's got, like, marine tightness sheets on his bunk. Like, he's sleeps on a cot.
The bed is for show.
Yeah, all he's got is, like, a footlocker at the base. He lives out of a trunk. But, you know, I don't even remember what I was going to say. Oh, damn it. It was a good one, though, I promise. So back in France, the family hasn't been able to get a flight back to Chicago for 2 days. And so mom has put her name on the standby list, and she's waiting at the airport. I don't understand why the whole family needs to go back. Couldn't one of the parents go back and let the rest of the family enjoy this trip instead of spending 20 hours out of a weekend on a plane?
Like, really, they could just send Kate home, or they could send the dad home. They don't need to include all the cousins. They don't need to keep Fuller on the plane. You know, they don't need to keep Uncle Frank in there.
Yeah.
Just send mom home. She'll figure it out. Make sure she doesn't have a panic attack. And
well, it's not even the uncle, because, like, well, I don't know. Maybe it is all of them, but I assumed it was just the McAllisters, the immediate McAllisters. The rest are all stuck in an apartment while Dad is still trying to phone people back home, and the kids are debating whether Kevin will be okay. I like Buzz in this scene listing his three reasons, though. A, 2, and D. and D, of course, being that they live on the most boring street in America where nothing exciting ever happens. Back in Chicago, Kevin has ordered a cheese pizza all to himself, and the pizza guy shows up and once again knocking over the jockey statue, and he finds a note on the door to deliver it to the back door, and Kevin uses the movie on the pizza guy to get him to leave it on the step and keep the change with his super generous 20-cent tip. He lets the movie keep playing to scare the pizza guy away with the sound of machine gun fire. Keep the change, you filthy animal. He's got this down to an art. Like, he knows exactly how long to push that fast forward button.
Yeah, he's got like timestamps beside him or something. He's got it written down in like a little notebook. He's like, all right, he's got it really figured out.
Yeah,
I've always found that like that would be so impossible. Like, it makes more sense in Home Alone 2 when he uses the Talk Boy, mm-hmm. because it's like he just records it and like his voice and modulates it.
Yeah,
but to like try to fast forward a movie is just, and when I'm thinking like on a VCR of all things, like it'd be a little bit easier now where you can see, you can actually see the time, but on a VCR.
Yeah, you're just scrubbing.
Yeah.
So mom back in Paris is trying to negotiate with a little old couple to let her buy their current tickets and pleads to her good nature as a mom. I like some of the things that she's offering though in this negotiation, where it's like the pocket translator and the earrings and everything like that. And what, like $500 and 2 first class tickets as long as they're willing to go in 2 days?
My favorite part about that is that she offers like everything in the kitchen sink, and the old lady goes, "Is that a real Rolex?
Yeah.
Is that a real Rolex? I'm thinking we need a little bit more grease on these wheels here. Like, come on, keep talking."
Yeah. This old lady that she's negotiating with is played by Billy Bird, who I definitely remember from Police Academy 4, but she has John Hughes connections too. She appeared in 16 Candles and Dennis the Menace, which John Hughes wrote. Plus, I had a listener point out to us on social media after listening to our Planes, Trains, and Automobiles that I missed talking about Bill Irwin in that movie, who plays her husband right here, who also appeared in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Plus other John Hughes connections. He was in She's Having a Baby and was also in Dennis the Menace with Billy Bird. Plus he appeared in an episode of Uncle Buck, the TV series, which was a short-lived TV series in the 80s. Back to Kevin, who is now regretting his wish to make his family disappear and is now wishing for them to come back. And next morning, we have another shower and some lip syncing in front of the mirror and another slap and scream. Kevin decides he needs to do some grocery shopping, and as Colin has said in one of our previous episodes, there's always something endearing about a little child acting like an adult, because at the checkout, he's chatting with the clerk about, you know, giving the microwave dinners a whirl, and he's reading a magazine, and the army guys he's buying are for the kids, and he has a coupon for that one, and he cut it out of this morning's newspaper. The checkout girl asks if he's alone, and of course he responds with, "Ma'am, I'm 8 years old. Do you really think I'd be alone? I don't think so." The total comes to like $19.83. That's a shitload of groceries for under $20 that he's got.
Yeah, honestly. The buying power of the dollar just 30 years ago?
The size of that bottle of Tide alone, that's like a $13.99 bottle of Tide there.
Yeah, plus tax.
Yeah. And then, of course, she asks, "Where's your mom? In the car? Your dad? At work? Brothers? Sisters? I'm an only child. Where do you live? I can't tell you that. Why not? You're a stranger."
I was wondering what Kevin's plan would have been if this whole situation had gone, you know, like even like a week. Because he steals Buzz's life savings, which really only look to be max $20.
Yeah.
So like, Was there more money hidden in the house? Like, I assume it's the 90s, so people probably had more cash on hand in the house.
Next scene, you see Kevin down at the pawn shop pawning a TV.
Yeah,
no, I actually did pause it in that moment and tried to count exactly how much he was pulling out of Buzz's box, but it went by too fast and it was too crumpled up. But I know that there were two ones in the front, so I don't know whether
on top, you
yeah,
know?
I don't know whether he had 100 crumpled in the back, but in the front it was only two crumpled up ones. So then at home, Kevin has conquered his fear of the basement to do laundry and realizes there's nothing to be scared of in the basement. And my kids were watching this movie with me, and my 8-year-old told me he wasn't doing the laundry correctly. And I'm like, well, maybe my kid could survive at home alone. Yeah. However, to me, this
a little more self-sufficient than you think.
Yeah, but this furnace is terrifying. Like, maybe I've just lived a sheltered life when it comes to furnaces, but between this and Christmas Story, I've now seen like two different furnaces that just boggle my mind. What's with the big door that opens on it? And I don't get this furnace.
I don't know. It looks like he pulled that furnace like straight off of an old like coal-powered train.
Oh,
like, it's
God.
Just so big and just like. You know, it's just industrial looking.
We have to go back to that one tagline. This is the horror movie. Like, there's a whole other story here, I think, but that involves this furnace and the killer next door and, you know, maybe burning bodies after he salts. Oh, yeah.
Okay. We'll pitch this one to Chris Columbus, too. Yeah. We'll give him a call.
Home Alone, what are they up to now? Six? Home Alone 6? Yeah. Let's make it into a Saw movie. So the wet bandits are back. To case the joint again and can't understand why it looks so dead now when last night the party was jumping. Like, were they expecting the party to still be going on or something?
What kind of rager do they think that they were throwing?
Right?
They're like, it's 12 hours later and they're not still drinking?
Woo! This is suburbia! Keep it going! Woo! So Harry sends Marv to poke around and he's testing the dog door. Where's their dog? Do the McAllisters actually have a dog? They must have like taken it to a kennel, but there's never any mention of a dog. But they have a dog door.
It's for Fuller.
Yeah.
It's just for Fuller.
So Kevin, who is in the kitchen doing dishes, and like I said, yeah, if my 8-year-old were left alone, there's no way he'd be doing dishes.
It's like Fortnite and YouTube, and you're good.
The other day, my kid grabbed a plastic spoon out of the drawer to eat his pudding instead of opening the dishwasher for a clean one. So there's no way he'd be standing at a sink hand washing fucking dishes, man. So, but with quick thinking, he turns on the movie that scared the pizza guy, and this stops the bandits in their tracks. And then he also uses firecrackers in a pot to accentuate the sound of the machine gun fire. And Marv, who is the one poking his foot through the door flap, runs back to the van and tells the tale of a rural gangster. And Harry decides that they'll stake out the place to see who comes out because someone is messing with their territory. So Mom, meanwhile, is having a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles storyline going on because she has managed to make it as far as Scranton, Pennsylvania, home of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company, and she can't get a flight the rest of the way to Chicago because everything's booked because it's Christmas Eve. Overhearing her dilemma, a band member named Gus from a polka band, played by the magnificent John Candy in an entirely improvised cameo, he comes over to offer her a ride because the band is in the process of renting a truck, and that's where they're headed, as long as she doesn't mind riding with some polka bums, and she enthusiastically accepts his gracious offer. Back at the McAllister house, Kevin has decided he needs a Christmas tree, so he heads outside to cut the top off the tree in the backyard. You know, this kid, holy shit, I now remember what I was going to say. They planted the seeds with this kid of just the kind of ingenuity he has right in the beginning when Dad is complaining that he's using his brand new fish hooks to make Christmas ornaments with the glue gun in the garage. So this kid is definitely way more creative than his brother and sisters. I wouldn't have thought when I was 8 years old to go chop the top off of a Christmas tree just so I could have a Christmas tree. However, I mean, for my kid, he'd just have to find my artificial one because I'm a terrible person that doesn't do real-life Christmas trees for my kids.
Too much work. At the end, you just toss it in a bag and you put it in the basement.
Or am I an amazing parent thinking of the environmental future?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You're an environmentalist. You're teaching your kids to respect the earth.
Yeah.
Unlike the wet bandits. Yeah. I still think an argument could be made for the fact that since they're wasting so much water in this whole neighborhood, they're actually eco-terrorists. But, oh, yeah. You know.
Oh, well, that could just add to the list of charges that they're going to have at the end. And, I mean, like, you can also add impersonating a police officer to that for Harry.
As much as I like the wet bandits, I find them very funny. I think their whole shtick, or at least Marv's shtick of flooding places, is just... It's such an unnecessary dick move.
Yeah.
Like, when you're already robbing these people of everything they have, and then you're also going to flood their house and make it unlivable, it's just so... Yeah.
And may I say, they're not just robbing these people. Like, you see when they're robbing the neighbor's house, he's just going through with the crowbar and just breaking
and just shit. Smashing shit. Yeah,
like, he's not trying to be sneaky or subtle about it at all. He's just walking through all willy-nilly. Yeah, you know, like he's singing in the rain with his cane, just breaking the whole house.
Yeah. Oh, more like a Clockwork Orange right there.
Exactly.
With the singing in the rain music, yeah. The ultra violence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on top of that, they're also driving around in a plumber's van. So it's just like this extra level of, this is how much we're assholes, is that we're advertising that we're plumbers and we're still going to flood your place. Like the slogan on the side of the van is kind of like, call us when you flood or something like that. Like there is actually a slogan on the side of the van that somehow relates to the fact that these guys flood people's houses, or at least the one guy does.
It would be hilarious if they actually were plumbers and then part of their grift was also that they flood people's places and make them think there's a problem, so then they get called in because their van is just roaming the streets, so it's like advertisement.
Yeah.
They get called in later to deal with the problem that they created.
Well, see,
they're double dipping.
But weren't you? Where was it? Was it you or was it Joel that was complaining about the story getting too complicated if Uncle Frank had been the kingpin? Because now you're just adding another layer that this movie doesn't necessarily need.
<He's> like, it makes sense because they're getting back in and they're putting their fingerprints all over it, so you know they won't get caught.
That's right. So back at the McAllister house, after cutting down his tree, the bandits see this happening and they're being scammed by a kindergartner. They go over to peep through the window where Kevin is trimming the tree and see he's alone, even though in a moment of brilliance, when Kevin sees them in the reflection on a Christmas bauble, he calls for his dad to come help. Another brilliant move by this 8-year-old. The bandits discuss that they'll come back at 9 p.m. because kids are afraid of the dark, which Kevin overhears because they're having this conversation really loud. So this seems like the perfect time for Kevin to run some errands, right?
Of course. What else?
First, he heads to see Santa because just like Ralphie in A Christmas Story, he realizes that he's overlooked the big man. He asks Santa, who he knows isn't the real Santa, to bring back his family. I've always been fascinated by this standalone Santa cabin in the park. Like, it's not like he's going to see, like, a mall Santa. Like, he's got his own little, like, murder shed in the middle of a town square somewhere.
That could be part of the, like, underlying potential horror story.
That's right.
I think we're onto something here. Like, I really think we're onto the real nitty-gritty of Home Alone.
Someone call Macaulay Culkin. He probably needs a job.
Yeah. Get Culkin on the phone. Yeah, he's looking. He's got his podcast. What else is he doing?
I also love when he asks Santa to bring back his family, and then Santa gives him Tic Tacs because
the fresh maker.
Anyone visiting Santa needs something. Chris Farley actually auditioned for the role of Santa. That would have been a lot of fun.
How did he not get it?
Right? I don't know.
They went, yes, sorry. We're too good for Chris Farley over here. Yeah. Like, come on.
Who is the guy who plays Santa to bump Chris Farley?
But I think in 1990, Chris Farley was still like brand new on Saturday Night Live. I think he was still one of the featured players. Kevin is now wandering around a bit and he watches a family through their windows celebrating Christmas and he gets introspective. And then he goes to a church because why not? You've got nothing else to do. It's not like you have more important things to be doing right now, Kevin. So the sounds of a choir has drawn him in and he sits to listen for a bit when he spots the scary neighbor Marley sitting a couple of pews over and he comes over to sit next to Kevin, wishing him a Merry Christmas. And I do love how Macaulay Culkin's face changes here when he's like got this look of terror on his face and then the guy says Merry Christmas and he gets like this quizzical, huh? Look on his face.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that too.
just the idea that it's like, this guy, he's so evil, he's a murderer. He would never wish someone Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
That means he's okay. That means he can sit beside me now.
Yeah, it's not like Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy. It's not like they were known for being really charming people.
No, or really nice. It's like, hey, this guy, hold on. I know he's got the scary white van, but I do love Mars bars. You know, he can't be.
Oh, but Marley, despite the urban legend reputation given to him by Buzz, turns out to be one of the kindest, most sensible people in this movie. Marley tells Kevin that there's no need to be afraid of him because he knows the rumors that people have of him. Then, in a John Hughesian moment, we get one of the scenes that has the most heart in this movie, about whether Kevin is a good kid or not, and Marley explaining that he came to watch his granddaughter sing in the choir because he's not welcome around her after falling out with his son. Kevin shows wisdom well beyond his years by telling him just to face his fears like he did in the basement and just call his son because every boy, no matter how old they get, needs their dad. But yet, through all this, Marley never questions why Kevin hasn't been seen with his parents for the last 2 days. You'd think there was a pretty good chance that the next-door neighbor had even seen the airport shuttle vans, or even the fact that Kevin has now found a trustworthy adult to confide in about his impending confrontation with the criminals. No, none of this shit comes up.
He goes, listen, the most important thing right now is me fixing your family, not the fact that I'm about to get, you know, my house is about to get burgled.
Yeah. Keep your eye on the prize, Kevin. Get your head in the game. So this whole tender moment is broken up by the church bells announcing that it's 8 o'clock, and Kevin has to hightail it out of there to set up his booby traps. Way to procrastinate, fucker! Like, 8 o'clock? Ugh! So Kevin has rushed home, gone through the front door that isn't locked, by the way. So for a movie centered around protecting his house, you'd think he'd secure it better. But he has to organize his plan, and it's a very astute and detailed plan for an 8-year-old. Even in my 40s, I don't think I'd be able to figure out something this intricate.
And in an hour.
Well, yeah, see, I feel like that the plan that he rolls out onto the desk, I feel like that was made ahead of time. I feel like that's the only forethought. He went to see Santa to get psyched. Like, this was his Rocky running up the stairs moment, was him going to visit Santa. You know, but yeah, I feel like that plan was made ahead of time. Something which, interestingly, Macaulay Culkin is the artist of that plan. He drew it out, yeah. So he sets up his micro machines in the front entryway, but takes his time to set them up just right, like with the ladder sticking up on the one of them. You're running out of time, asshole!
Detail is everything, okay?
he tars the stairs to the basement, he pokes a nail through a piece of sandpaper to add to the tarred stairs, uses the hose to ice down all the stairs outside, tying ropes to paint cans, and sets up a zip line from the attic to his treehouse. And he heats up the doorknob with, what exactly is that thing? I know it's from the grill. Is that like a charcoal starter or something? The weird loop thing with the, yeah,
sure,
the heating
I've
element?
I've always been curious, because there was a part of me, I remember when I was a kid, I always thought that it was also the blowtorch. Like, he used that, and then he used it later on when he committed a heinous crime and burned that guy's scalp off. You know, committed an awful, awful act.
It kind of looks like a branding iron almost, or something like an electronic one that just holds its, but I've never really known what that thing is.
Yeah,
like
everyone's got one of those laying around, a branding iron.
Yeah, he pulls it out of a charcoal grill though, so I have to assume it's got to be like some sort of like element to light charcoal, because charcoal is a bitch to light, but charcoal is also something that I've only ever used like at the cabin. Yeah, so yeah.
And also, what kind of 8-year-old knows how to fully disassemble a charcoal grill to use its element and then like hot wire that into something else and hook it up to a doorknob,
right?
Yeah.
So now he sits down for his dinner of macaroni and cheese just as the clock strikes 9. Oh, he doesn't get to eat because it's go time, bitches. He grabs Buzz's BB gun and gets ready to get it on. But really, why would the wet bandits even bother trying to rob this place now that they know someone is home? Even if it's a fucking kid. That's a witness. Like, you'd have to kill him.
That's. I think that was their goal. They were going in there with that crowbar. Yeah.
They were
going
to bust some heads.
Yeah, they were going really clockwork horns with it.
I was just thinking, like, you know, because Kevin seems comfortable enough to leave his house and go to all these places and talk to people but never tell them what's going on.
Yeah.
But you have to think, as smart as he is, at some point he would have thought to go to a policeman and kind of explain. But I'm wondering if that if that's the whole reason they set up that shoplifting angle where he feels like a criminal, like so early on to now he's like too afraid to go to the police because he doesn't want, he doesn't want to go to jail himself.
I think they also set that up a little bit earlier in the film, especially with like the mom calling the police department. They really set up that Sergeant Balzac and the rest of the police department are incredibly incompetent. Like they just don't care. And the guy that's that comes to the door and is like, yeah, tell her to count her kids again. You know, I knocked like seven times and nobody responded.
He also never identifies himself as a police officer.
No, he just gives it a couple knocks like the Girl Scouts do.
Yeah. But, you know, and also to your point about maybe they set up that whole shoplifting storyline to make him feel like a criminal, like that, that adds an extra layer to the fact that his master plan is to get the wet bandits over into one of the houses they've already robbed. So, you know, like, I already thought that that's a brilliant ending to this plan that he's figured out is, okay, but we're not going to catch him in my house. We're going to frame them in another house. And so, I mean, maybe that's the extra, you know, he wants to make sure that for his toothbrush theft, they don't know where the McAllister residence is, you know? So the bandits start their onslaught, trying the back door and intimidation first. Harry takes a BB to the nuts and Marv one to the forehead. Ralphie in A Christmas Story would have probably gone for the eye.
Yeah.
So they changed tactics using a two-pronged approach. Harry going for the front door, Marv to the back door. And this is where you have to suspend your disbelief and try to ignore how intensely violent this should be. So,
oh my gosh, it's gruesome.
Yeah. Harry is the victim of the slip and fall on his back down a few steps. Now, Joe Pesci is about 5 years older than I am currently when he filmed this movie, and I feel like falling off four steps onto my back onto concrete at 42, I'd be done.
I am 21 and in pretty good, you know, shape.
Yeah.
If I fell, you know, flat on my ass off of two steps onto concrete, I'd be like, I'll have my appointments called off for the week.
Yeah, I'm done.
I'm gonna go sit in a bath for 48 hours straight and just take a whole bottle of Robax. Like, it's good. It's been fun while it lasted.
So Harry is also then a victim to getting his hand burnt, a blowtorch burning his head, then honey or glue, whatever it is, on plastic wrap and feathered, which is really, I mean, that's such a pussy little trap that he's set up with the tar and feather. Like, come on.
You put a nail through the other guy's foot and you're about to crash his skull in with a paint can and you're like, all right. Tar and feather guys, that'll get them.
That one's just to like take their dignity away. It has nothing. It's emotional pain more than anything.
Yeah, because poor Harry is all about the burning, and poor Marv is all about like head and foot trauma. Because Marv first slips down the basement stairs, then goes to turn on a pull chain light, which is actually a decoy that instead hits him in the face with an iron falling down the laundry chute. There's a cracked orbital bone right there. He loses his socks and shoes and then on the tar steps and then steps on a nail.
That one hurts to watch.
It does, doesn't it, right?
That one, yeah.
And then he tries to go through a window only to step on Christmas ornaments. Like, who wouldn't look down first?
Yeah.
Those Christmas ornaments are actually made out of like spun candy,
like candy
spun sugar candy. Yeah. Oh. So yeah. So that, you know, he doesn't actually, cut it, slice his feet to pieces. Cause that's what would really fucking happen. But
Die Hard.
Yeah.
So, like glass right in the foot.
So they end up slipping on the micro machines. Thanks for planting that seed in the beginning, Dad. And they are baited by Kevin, who ends up swinging paint cans at them. Now, I've established on this show before, I'm no physics expert, but the angles on these paint cans seem like entirely wrong. Because once they stop swinging, they're hanging there directly in front of where the guys are. So the way he's throwing them up over the balcony, really, they should like land flat on their head. They shouldn't be coming at them with a swinging force.
No, like a pendulum, like a perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but where they're hanging when they're stationary, that railing isn't far enough back for it to actually get a pendulum motion. I mean, come on.
Also, what was the anchor point you were using? Because that's not good. If you swing a paint can off of like a drywall anchor point, it's like your whole house is going to come down.
Well, he had it tied right to the banister.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, he's also a knots expert, apparently.
Yeah. Again, this guy, fuck the Boy Scouts, you know?
Yeah.
He's straight up the ranks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's like Liam Neeson in Taken. He's got just a very special set of skills for dealing with home invaders.
This is really his "my time has come" moment. Like he's spending, he's like an apocalypse prepper, just waiting for something to go wrong. He spent his whole life prepping to just beat the shit out of a couple, like, you know, bad criminals coming into his house. He's like, finally.
He keeps a go bag in the front closet. Yeah, so Kevin now finally phones 911, doing his incredible impression of an older person. With this deep voice, like, how did 911 be like, okay, this is legit? When his mom calls from Paris and explains everything fully about, hey, yeah, I left my kid at home, send someone to check on him, they give her the runaround, whereas this guy is like, my name is Johnson, send someone quick, bye.
Yeah, I'm grown McPherson. Hello? Hello?
He continues to taunt them and gets them to follow him up to the attic, and he almost gets caught but gets away thanks to Buzz's tarantula showing up at that moment, something that they've made sure to sporadically remind us of throughout this movie. He makes his escape across the zipline made from an old bike handlebar, so now he's a welder?
Oh, you don't just keep like a little torch and mask on you at all times, just in case. This guy has gone from making ornaments with hot glue and fish hooks to just TIG welding
in 3 days.
Maybe that's why we don't see Kevin's room, because his room is just some insane science lab.
It's weird, like some Stewie workshop. It's like, yeah, Stewie and the Family Guy. He's got a closet full of like a time machine and shit.
Exactly. See, all right, guys, and this brings you to this episode's sponsor of Skillshare. If you ever need to set up your house to be, you know, fight off burglars in a period of 3 days and learn how to TIG weld, by all means.
And this is pre-Google, so I mean, like, this kid, he's gone to encyclopedias for, he went to the library, he used the Dewey Decimal System to figure out how to make a handlebar that it would double as a zipline.
Thank you, Melville.
From the treehouse, he taunts the bad guys to come and get him, or else he's going to call the cops. Well, this reverse psychologizing, which, so I guess he's a psychologist too, it's worked on them, because instead of doing the logical thing of going downstairs, they both decide to climb across the rope hand over hand. And this, of course, was all part of the 8-year-old's plan, because he cuts the rope with head shears. He taunts them some more, getting them to follow him to a neighbor's house across the street, and finally, able to outsmart a second grader, they choose not to follow him through the flooded basement, but instead catch him at the top of the stairs. They're talking about doing all the same things that he did to them, like burning him and smashing him in the face with an iron. Oh, what they say they're going to do to him is way more violent than what actually...
That's just one of my scenes that I absolutely love. And this was the year, like, this is the same year that Goodfellas came out, which Joe Pesci won his Academy Award for. And may I say, I think that he should have been double nominated. Like, I think it was Jack Nicholson was for Chinatown and for something else. He got double nominated for the Academy Award just for his delivery of the way that he told a child he was going to bite their fingers off.
Yeah.
That alone.
I read a couple of things about Joe Pesci in this movie. One was that he played the role super method. So he wouldn't interact with Macaulay Culkin at all while they were filming, because he wanted him to be afraid of him.
Yeah.
And then the second thing was, in this scene, when he mentions, like, I'm going to bite your fingers off, there was one take where he actually did bite his finger, and Macaulay Culkin still has, like, a scar because he drew blood.
Really?
Outstanding.
Animal. And they were like, yeah, I say Macaulay, all right, let me just patch that one up, and we're running it again. Yeah. Again, a little bit less intensity this time.
I just imagine, because, I mean, like, I don't know. This always happens when you're playing with little kids and they get hurt, and it's especially when it's not your kid, and you're always kind of like, oh, no, it's okay. Nothing happened. It's okay. And I just imagine Joe Pesci biting this kid and being like, oh, no, don't worry. Just cover it up. Don't worry about it. We'll just keep filming.
Oh, you see, no, I went the complete opposite way with that. I thought you were going to be like, imagine Joe Pesci biting his finger and just being like, yeah, take it.
Yeah.
Take it.
That, yeah.
Use this.
Yeah, you think I'm funny? You think I'm a clown? He starts dropping some Goodfellas lines on. he ramps it up to Goodfellas or Raging Bull, like, in intensity.
Yeah, Macaulay Culkin starts crying, and he's like, you're ruining this shot. You're never going to make it in this industry. You're nothing.
So they're talking about biting off his fingers when Marley shows up and knocks them out with a shovel. More effective than everything else they got hit in the head with is this one shovel.
Can.
A paint can, fucking iron. Yeah, a shovel in the back of the head. A big...
Oh, and the crowbar to the ribs?
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Marley takes Kevin home, and Kevin watches from the window as the Wet Bandits get arrested, and now they've got bruises on their face. And, of course, because of Marv's stupid calling card flooding idea, the cops know every house they've ever robbed. Kevin puts out milk and cookies for Santa and heads to bed, and presumably cleans everything up.
He cleans up the whole Rube Goldberg machine of death that he turned his house into, so that his parents can come home and be like, none the wiser.
He swept up all those feathers. What about the tar steps? Did he scrape all the tar off those fucking steps? Because when the parents do come home, the only thing that they find is his gold tooth. Like, he's cleaned up everything. Like he's gone total crime scene cleanup. He's the fixer. He's that guy that the mob calls to clean up the house when they're done, but he missed a tooth.
He's one of the guys in John Wick with the token, and they bring him in and he cleans it up.
Yeah. Or Pulp Fiction when they call Harvey Keitel.
I love that the only thing he doesn't clean up just to stick it to Buzz is Buzz's room.
Right?
Yeah. Fuck you, Sean's Buzz.
Yeah. That's my favorite scene. He knows how to do everything except hang shelves.
That's my favorite thing is Buzz comes in and he goes, hey, man, good job not burning the house down. And then you miss the 30 seconds later where Buzz walks up to his room and goes, what the fuck?
So, he's put out milk and cookies for Santa. He heads to bed. Next morning, he wakes up and runs downstairs to see if his family's back. And they aren't. But you'd think that the 8-year-old might take note of the fact that the milk and cookies are still there. You know, after telling that other Santa that he knows how it works, it's like, I'd look at that milk and cookies and go, oh, shit.
See,
wait a minute.
I love that scene, because he was like, I know how it works.
Yeah.
But he's like, I know you just report to him. You're not the real one.
Yeah. as he's putting out his smoke and waving the smoke away. Yeah. While he's sadly staring at a picture of his family, Mom comes home. They're reunited at last! And then, just to rub salt in how futile her harrowing journey was, the rest of the family arrives 2 minutes later, having just waited for the later flight. Buzz gives Kevin some respect for not burning the house down, like Joel said, and Dad is impressed when he finds out that Kevin went grocery shopping for eggs, milk, and fabric softener. I just want to point out that, I did my sponsorship corner, so I'm always looking for products. I saw no eggs in the shopping cart, and he bought Tide laundry detergent, not fabric softener. So one out of three.
Yeah, and also, how would there be eggs? Because they clearly showed his bags all ripped.
Yeah.
Oh, what kind of eggs are they making? What kind of GMO, rubberized eggs do they have?
So maybe he bought them and I just didn't see them, and the laundry detergent landed on them and he didn't bother cleaning them up.
That's the one thing he didn't clean up. That's the one thing. He left the eggs and the gold tooth.
Yeah. Dad asked, what else did you do while we were away? Oh, just hung around. And this was where it was supposed to end in a hug and a freeze frame. But I also still don't understand why everyone had to come home early.
That's a pretty costly flight home.
Yeah.
And to not have really enjoyed your vacation at all.
And I'm assuming it was a week-long trip to Paris, because they didn't even put up a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
So there was the implication they were going to be back way later, New Year's.
Yeah. Everyone disperses, and Kevin wanders over to the window in time to see that Marley took his advice and has been reunited with his estranged family. And while watching them, we hear Buzz yell, Kevin, what did you do to my room? And the end. And like we've asked a few times on the show, what does the next day look like in the McAllister household? I mean, there's gotta...
Spotless.
Yeah, did he really get everything except the tooth? Everyone is so happy to see him now, but what does tomorrow look like?
And they obviously wouldn't have shown this, but there's also the implication that he cleaned up, a lot of blood. Because obviously they can't show the blood, but, the guy lacerated the entirety of his bare feet. First of all, this whole movie is just an OH&S commercial for the importance of proper booting and, steel toes,
That is Home Alone. Now, Colin, Joel, on IMDb, it scored a 7.6 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 63. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 65% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 80%. But Colin, before we find out how we feel, like a paint can to the head, why don't you hit us with some words from the critics?
Alrighty. So I was actually very shocked to see how different the Rotten Tomatoes score was. Because all I know about Home Alone, I don't know a single person who doesn't like Home Alone. So it seems like at the time it came out, the critics weren't overly a fan of it. So here we go. So TV Guide said, "The only really likable thing about this film is Culkin. He's an uncommonly natural child actor, but even he doesn't always survive the tiresome gags. The aftershave bit is funny once, three times is tedious."
It only happened twice.
Yeah, yeah. Throw the review out. Your opinion is nothing.
Yeah, next! Clearly.
And, I mean, you guys, he screams like four times or whatever. That might be what they're talking about.
Maybe, but yeah.
It's still funny every time.
Yeah.
I don't care. Roger Ebert with the Chicago Sun-Times said, "If Home Alone had limited itself to the things that might possibly happen to a forgotten 8-year-old, I think I would have liked it more." Which, I mean, come on, Roger Ebert.
Come on, like... Roger. Come on, Roger. I thought that he would have given a pretty fair review, because he's normally like...
Yeah. Yeah. But then I thought, like, what would possibly happen to a forgotten 8-year-old? Death? Like, I don't know if that's... I don't know. If that's what I want to watch.
Are you upset that he was competent? That he survived? Oh, man. Roger Ebert wanted the horror movie.
Yeah. You know, Sean, you know what we're thinking, right? As a little podcast experiment, you are just going to fuck off for like a week come Christmas and just see what happens to your kids.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, a real life 8-year-old, I don't think would be able to cook very well. They wouldn't be able to, like, Kevin couldn't even pack a suitcase like we've said. So I don't know. I don't think that would have been as interesting of a movie as Roger Ebert would have liked to believe.
At least he got microwave dinners. So we're not actually watching him like boil water on the stove and pulling casseroles out of the oven.
But I still feel like microwave dinners of the 90s required you to remember that there's like you have to take the metal parts off before you stick it in the microwave.
Yeah, you gotta change the wattage and stuff.
Yeah. And then the last one is Owen Gleiberman with Entertainment Weekly. And he said, "The movie devolves into an egregious Three Stooges pain fest. We were meant to giggle and clap along with Kevin as the crooks get their heads singed with blowtorches and walk barefoot on glass." So he's like, you know, the kid was really mean to the bad guys, so I don't know that we should applaud such violence. And I'm just like, come on. Yeah. What's wrong with people? This is why I hate critics. Like,
yeah.
Why can't you just have fun?
Yeah, I mean, you know, thanks to a movie like Die Hard, I know what it looks like when you walk on glass. And that doesn't necessarily belong in a movie like Home Alone.
I mean, that being said, I think there's a lot of parallels between Die Hard and Home Alone.
Oh, very much, yeah.
Considering Home Alone was released only 2 years after, and it follows pretty much like the exact same beats along the way.
Yeah.
I was surprised to find that Home Alone is classified as an action comedy. And it held the record for like the highest grossing action comedy until I think 2015. I can't remember right now.
I think it was like The Hangover 2, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Action, Home Alone, like when I think of action comedy, I think of like the Die Hard or Lethal Weapon or like Rush Hour, that kind
Beverly
of thing.
Hills
I don't
Cop,
think
yeah.
of, I don't think of Home Alone. There you go.
Right on. So yeah, like I said, we've got, you know, somewhere around 80 from audiences and somewhere around mid-60s for critics. Joel, you're our special guest this week. Look beyond the nostalgia. Where does this really fall for you?
This is a movie that it's so hard to look beyond the nostalgia for, but looking at it from a purely critical standpoint, I understand like a kind of 7.6. I'd put it as like a 7.8, 7.9.
Yeah.
I don't think it's in that like 8, 9, 10 especially. Kind of film, but I'm like, I get it. I'm definitely not as harsh on this movie as like the critics of the time would have been. It's just like, look at what it was trying to do. I think it accomplished very well, and that it was trying to make like a, I guess what you could qualify as like an action comedy about like a misunderstood kid that would appeal to like children and parents. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it accomplished its goal very well.
Yeah. Colin, what about you? I think I know where you're. This is a 10 out of 10 for you, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Joel. Like, I don't know that I can rate it without nostalgia. I think, to me, this movie, there's not another movie like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, the McCall, even Lost in New York, like, I kind of see them both as, like, one movie at this point. But it's, like, there's nothing, the only other movie like this movie is Home Alone 2. There's not another movie that, like, has a kid in kind of, like, I guess, like, adult situations. Even though it is a kid's movie, it still does have that level of violence where it's kind of adult, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of just think it's one of those movies for me that it's timeless. I've never seen another movie like it, and yeah, I cannot in good conscience rate it anything below a 9.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah, with the nostalgia, it's like a nostalgia 9-10 for me, minimum, because I love it so much.
Yeah.
I think if I were to look at like the like some of the cinematic things, or like the story, I'd be like, the story is simple, but I think today's sometimes movies are too complex, like they try to do too much.
True.
And so, yeah, I don't know.
You would have had
I love it.
You would have had Uncle Frank as the kingpin, is what you would have had. I get right behind, you know, a solid 80% as well. Like, I enjoyed it, and we're at episode 19 now, and this is the first movie I've actually been able to watch with my kids, which is something that I appreciate, it because it's one that I'm actually happy to show my kids, and I think it still holds up. And the action, it's that action comedy. It's their way to see an action film without me absolutely destroying my kids by showing them something that they shouldn't be watching at the age of 8.
I think the one thing too I'm always impressed with every time I watch this movie is Macaulay Culkin's actually a good actor for a child actor. I feel like if you were to make movies, like most movies that revolve around a child actor, it's hard to get past how like stiff the kid is usually. But he just plays it so well.
I do know that I absolutely love Macaulay Culkin in Uncle Buck. I think his character in Uncle Buck is so good. And you see some of the wit here. Like, he is great. Like, he's great at memorizing lines. That might be the best way to put it, is he's given some awfully complex dialogue at points. Like, the whole scene where he's talking with the clerk in the supermarket, you know, like, all of his speeches with Marley in the church, like, he's taking some very adult stuff and delivering it quite well for a kid that small.
Again, it's the naturalness of it, like you said. It's not dialogue. It's a character. Like, it's a person.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that his like personal life got so like messed up. Like, it would have been interesting to see what his career could have been if he actually was able to kind of keep going.
Yeah, I suggest that you go watch that Drivers, because you'll see that he's still got it. But there we go. There's got to be some Michael Jackson joke I'm missing out of this entire episode, huh?
Oh, no.
Well, there we go. That's Home Alone.
Yeah.
And that's our show for this week. Huge thank you to our holiday guest, Joel Sims. Joel, thanks for joining us. If people want to find you on the old interwebs out there, where can they find you?
My Instagram is just Joel Simsy, so JoelSimsay at the end. I don't have a Twitter because I used to browse Twitter a lot, and then with the current political climate, I decided I didn't want to put worms in my brain.
Probably.
So I deleted that.
Yeah.
Good call. Good call.
Yeah. I saw you have a notepad in front of you. Is there any last words that something I breezed over that you didn't have a chance to chime in on? Any last words?
I think my big thing that I'd like to retouch on, that I talked about in the beginning, is the idea of like, this movie does such an amazing job of showing what a kid thinks is the ideal adult life. And the transition from what a kid thinks is the ideal adult life to doing what is pretty normal adult things. Like, he goes from, like you said, being an absolute barnyard animal, jumping on the bed, eating ice cream, making a big mess, to just doing normal adult things through his, like, you know, hero's journey, if you will. Like, it's true. He actually has like a pretty good hero's journey in this movie.
He has a good arc.
He ticks all the boxes.
Yeah.
And, you know, just eating absolute garbage. And just feeling like this is the life. Like, it just really takes me back to when I was like a kid. And for the first time, my dad was like, here's $5. Walk down to the corner store and get yourself something.
Yeah.
You know, when you walk up to that corner store and you go, yeah, I'll get this Slurpee and this pack of gum. And you're like, yeah. I'm an adult now. I'm 10 years old. I just bought some gum. I'm ready for the real world. You know, it perfectly captures that, I think. Just that feeling of a child's idea of independence and freedom.
Right on.
Yeah.
You know, and then winding up just doing adult things, like sitting in your bed, sad and alone, watching Johnny Carson, going, I miss my family. And then washing the laundry wrong, much like your kid said.
So if you like that show, tell your friends, share our posts. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast. Or one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say. It's not for our egos, but it's those 5 stars. They just drive us up the charts and they help us get noticed.
Yeah, and we love to hear from people. So if you want to email us, you can reach us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. You can also check out our social media. We have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. There you can find all the posts. Like, I'm sure Sean will link to that driver video. But we also have other videos from stuff that we've talked about in our previous episodes. And social media ultimately is the best place to find out what we're going to be watching next so that you can watch it too. Also, check out our website. It's www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all the episodes as well as the links to our social media. So go check it out.
And also, if you want to be one of our heroes and become a producer of the show, you can donate to us on Patreon by going to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon family. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals, and also he now has a solo song out. Anywhere you listen to music, thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another Christmas movie. We go from Colin's favorite Christmas movie to my favorite Christmas movie on I Used to Like This One.